Chapter 13. Further south, the snow and ice became impermanent, though it was still cold by non-Nilt standards. Nilters regard the equatorial region as a sort of tropical paradise, where grain can actually grow, where the temperature can easily exceed 8 or 9 degrees C. Most of Nilt's large cities are on or near the equatorial ring. The same is true of the planet's one claim to any sort of fame, the glass bridges. These are approximately 5-meter-wide ribbons of black, hanging in gentle catenaries across trenches nearly as wide as they are deep. Dimensions measured in kilometers. No cables, no piers, no trusses. Just the arc of black attached to each cliff face. Fantastic arrangements of colored glass coils and rods hang from the bottoms of the bridges, sometimes projecting sideways. The bridges themselves are, according to all observations, also made of glass, though glass could never possibly withstand the sort of stress these bridges do. Even their own weight should be too much for them, suspended as they are with nothing for support. There are no rails or handholds, just the drop, and at the bottom, kilometers down, a cluster of thick-walled tubes, each one just 1.5 meters wide, empty and smooth-walled. These are made of the same material as the bridges. No one knows what the bridges and the tubes beneath them were for, or who built them. They were here when humans first colonized Nilt. Theories abound, each one less likely than the one before. Interdimensional beings feature prominently in many of them. These either created or shaped humanity for its own purposes, or left a message for humans to decipher for obscure reasons of their own. Or they were evil, bent on destruction of all life. The bridges were, somehow, part of their plan. Another whole subfield claims the bridges were built by humans, some ancient, long-lost, fantastically advanced civilization that either died out, slowly, pathetically, or spectacularly as the result of some catastrophic mistake, or moved on to a higher level of existence. Advocates of this sort of theory often make the additional claim that Nilt is, in reality, the birthplace of humans. Nearly everywhere I've been, popular wisdom has it that the location of humanity's original planet is unknown, mysterious. In fact, it isn't, as anyone who troubles to read on the subject will discover, but it is very, very, very far away from nearly anywhere, and not a tremendously interesting place. Or at the very least, not nearly as interesting as the enchanting idea that your people are not newcomers to their homes, but in fact only recolonized the place they had belonged from the beginning of time. One meets this claim anywhere one finds a remotely human habitable planet. The bridge outside Therid wasn't much of a tourist attraction. Most of the jewel-bright arabesques of glass had shattered over thousands of years, leaving it nearly plain. And Therid is still too far north for non-Milters to endure comfortably. Off-world visitors generally confine themselves to the better-preserved bridges on the equator. Buy a Bove hair blanket, guaranteed hand-spun and hand-woven by masters of the craft in the unbearably cold reaches of the world, though these are almost certainly turned out on machines, by the dozen, a few kilometers from the gift shop. Choke down a few fetid swallows of fermented milk, and return home to regale their friends and associates with tales of their adventure. All this I learned within a few minutes of knowing I would need to visit Nilt to achieve my aim. Therid sat on a broad river, chunks of green and white ice bobbing and crashing in its current, the first boats of the season already moored at the docks. On the opposite side of the city, The dark slash of the bridge's huge trough made a definitive stop to the straggling edge of houses. The southern edge of the city was Flyer Parks, then a wide complex of blue and yellow painted buildings that was, by the look of it, a medical facility, one that must have been the largest of its kind in the area. It was surrounded by squares of lodgings and food shops and swaths of houses, bright pink, orange, yellow, red, in stripes and zigzags and crosshatches. We had flown half the day. I might have flown all night, I was capable of it, though it would have been unpleasant. But I saw no need for haste. I sat down in the first empty space I found, told Savard and Kirtley to get out, and did so myself. I shouldered my pack, paid the parking fee, disabled the flyer, as I had at Striegan's, and set off toward the city, not looking to see if Savarden followed. I had sat down near the medical facility. The lodgings surrounding it were some of them luxurious, but many were smaller and less comfortable than the one I'd rented in the village where I'd found Savarden, though a bit more expensive. Bright-coated southerners came and went, speaking a language I didn't understand. Others spoke the one I knew, and fortunately, this was the same language the signs used. I chose lodging, roomier, at least, than the suspension pod-size holes that were the cheapest available, and took Savarden off to the first clean-looking and moderately priced food shop I could find. When we entered, Savarden eyed the shelves of bottles on the far wall.
They have arrack.
It'll be incredibly expensive, I said, and probably not very good. They don't make it here. Have a beer instead. She had been showing some signs of stress and wincing slightly at the profusion of bright colors, so I expected some sort of irritable outburst, but instead she merely gestured acquiescence. Then she wrinkled her nose, slight disgust.
What do they make beer out of here?
Grain. It grows nearer the equator. It's not as cold there. We found seats on the benches that lined three rows of long tables, and a waiter brought us beer and bowls of something she told us was the house specialty.
Extra beautiful eating, yes, she said, in a badly mangled approximation of Radchai.
And it was, in fact, quite good, and turned out to have actual vegetables in it. A good proportion of thinly sliced cabbage, among whatever the rest of it was. The smaller lumps appeared to be meat, probably bove. Savarden cut one of the larger lumps in two with her spoon, revealing plain white.
Probably cheese, I said. She grimaced. Why can't these people eat real food? Don't they know better?
Cheese is real food, so is cabbage.
But this sauce
tastes good. I took another spoonful.
This whole place smells funny, she complained.
Just eat. She looked dubiously at her bowl, scooped a spoonful, sniffed it. It can't possibly smell worse than that fermented milk drink, I said. She actually half smiled.
No.
I took another spoonful, pondering the implications of this better behavior. I wasn't sure what it meant. About her state of mind, about her intentions, about who or what she thought I was. Maybe Striegan had been right, and Savarden had decided the most profitable course, for now, was to not alienate the person who was feeding her, and that would change as soon as her options changed. A high voice called out from another table.
Hello?
I turned. The girl with the tick-tick set waved to me from where she sat with her mother. For an instant I was surprised, but we were near the medical center where I knew they had brought their injured relative, and they had come from the same direction we had, and so they had likely parked on the same side of town. I smiled and nodded, and she got up and came to where we were sitting.
Your friend is better, she said brightly. That's good. What are you eating?
I don't know, I admitted. The waiter said it was the house specialty.
Oh, that's very good. I had it yesterday. When did you get here? It's so hot, it's like summer already. I can't imagine what it's like further north.
Clearly, she'd had time to recover her more usual spirits since the accident that had brought her to Striegen's house. Saevarden, spoon in hand, watched her, bemused. We've been here an hour, I said. We're only stopping for the night, on our way to the ribbon.
We're here until Uncle's legs are better, which will probably be another week.
She frowned, counting days.
A little longer. We're sleeping in our flyer, which is terribly uncomfortable, but Mama says the price for lodging here is outright theft.
She sat down on the end of the bench next to me.
I've never been in space. What's it like?
It's very cold. Even you would find it cold. She thought that was funny, gave a little laugh. And of course there's no air, and hardly any gravity, so everything just floats. She frowned at me, mock rebuke.
You know what I mean.
I glanced over to where her mother sat, stolid, eating, unconcerned. It's really not very exciting. The girl made a gesture of indifference.
Oh, you like music. There's a singer at a place down the street tonight.
She used the word I had used mistakenly, not the one she had corrected me with in Striegen's house.
We didn't go to hear her last night because they charge. And besides, she's my cousin. Or she's in the next lineage over from mine, and she's my mother's cousin's daughter's aunt. That's close enough, anyway. I heard her at the last ingather. She's very good.
I'll be sure to go. Where is it? She gave me the name of the place, and then said she had to finish her supper. I watched her go back to her mother, who only looked up briefly and gave a curt nod, which I returned. The place the girl had named was only a few doors down, a long, low-ceilinged building, its back wall all shutters, open just now on a walled yard, where Nilter sat uncoated in the one-degree air drinking beer, listening silently to a woman playing a bowed stringed instrument I'd never seen before. I quietly ordered beer for myself and Saevarden, and we took seats on the inner side of the shutters, slightly warmer than the yard for the lack of a breeze, and with a wall to put our backs against. A few people turned to look at us, stared a moment, then turned away more or less politely. Saevarden leaned 3 centimeters in my direction and whispered, "Why are we here?" "To hear the music." She raised an eyebrow. "This is music?" I turned to look at her directly. She flinched, just slightly. "Sorry, it's just..." She gestured helplessly. "Rodchai do have stringed instruments, quite a variety of them, in fact, accrued through several annexations. But playing them in public is considered a slightly risque act, because one has to play either barehanded or in gloves so thin as to be nearly pointless. And this music, the long, slow, uneven phrases that made its rhythms difficult for the Rodchai ear to hear, the harsh, edged tone of the instrument, wasn't what Saevarden had been brought up to appreciate. It's so... A woman at a nearby table turned and made a reproving shushing noise. I gestured conciliation and turned a cautioning look on Saevarden. For a moment, her anger showed in her face, and I was sure I would have to take her outside. But she took a breath and looked at her beer and drank, and afterward looked steadily ahead in silence. The piece ended, and the audience rapped fists gently on their tables. The string player somehow looked both impassive and gratified, and launched into another. This one noticeably faster, and loud enough for Saevarden to safely whisper to me again, "How long are we going to be here?" "A while," I said. "I'm tired. I want to go back to the room." "Do you know where it is?" She gestured assent. The woman at the other table eyed us disapprovingly. "Go," I whispered as quietly as I could and still, I hoped, be heard by Saevarden. Saevarden left. Not my concern anymore, I told myself, whether she found her way back to our lodgings. And I congratulated myself on having had the foresight to lock my pack in the facility's safe for the night, even without Stregan's warning. I didn't trust Savardin with my belongings or my money. Or wandered aimlessly through the city, or walked into the river and drowned. Whatever she did, it was no concern of mine and nothing I needed to worry about.